Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Tuesday, May 25th. Before we start our work, could we please have a roll call for attendance?
Representative Levy.
Levy present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is present by video.
Representative Smith is excused. Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video, but having technical difficulties, and so will be getting in any way he can. So there you go.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Thank you, everybody. We have a number of items on our agenda today. These are work sessions for discussion purposes only, and we will take the items in the order in which they are listed, except there is one that is not ready today, House Bill 2630, which is a school fund stabilization measure, is being carried over. It's just not quite ready for us yet. So again, House Bill 2630, not today. We're carrying it over. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3295.
Good afternoon. Oh, sorry.
Hi, Rep. Hang on. We're going to have a brief introduction from LRO first.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 3295, you have heard a couple of times. This is the latest go around of marijuana revenue distributions. The issue, just to refresh your memory, is how the distribution of the revenues that are collected by the state would be distributed to counties through the distribution formula for the 10% that the county get out of the state marijuana revenue. Under current law, it has two segments to this formula, 50% based on production and canopy, and another 50% based on the rest of businesses compared to the state. What you have today is a dash four amendment, and the dash four amendment, what it does is replace the bill as it stands, and what it does in addition to the county distribution changes or the county distribution alignment is to have simplify the language of Measure 110 and then allow for the counties who had prior businesses before they do any or did any opting out provision ordinances to be grandfathered in if after the period of January 1st, 2018. However, it also requires that there is a condition of establishing a panel, a cannabis advisory panel. And that cannabis advisory panel would have two places to operate. One is for any county that is thinking about opting out, is to establish that panel from the different segments of the business and government. And also, if a county that have opted out between the year 2018 and 2021, it would have that advisory panel also established before it gets the reintroduction of the distribution into the county formula. And it makes the operative date for the bill at 1/1/2022. That's the -4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Malik. Rep. Krupp, welcome to the meeting.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to present again today.
Yeah. Yes, we'd like to hear about what you've been working on for this bill and the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Thank you, Vice Chair Zreski and Vice Chair Pham. I'm Jason Krupp, State Representative for House District 54 in Bend, Oregon. And thank you for allowing me to talk to you today about our -4 amendment. I've been working on this bill with Representative Jack Zika. And as you remember, House Bill 3295 is about ensuring each county receives its fair share of revenue based on this county's overall participation in Oregon's marijuana economy. The current funding model is the more you participate in that economy, the more of that revenue source you are to receive. Just to reiterate also, this measure does not have any impact on the distributions under Measure 110. It would not have any impact on distributions of revenue if the Marijuana Equity Act was passed this session. You heard previous testimony from Rob Beauvais. There was unintended or certainly unanticipated result that is can occur with the Department of Revenue reads this measure. That is, if a county opts out of one of the different types of licenses, they lose all their marijuana revenue. So the situation could exist, or does exist, where a county has businesses of all types of licenses, production, processing, wholesale and retail. And if it puts a limit on new, say production, and even though it allows for new retail licenses, the Department of Revenue reads the current statute as saying you do not receive any revenue whatsoever. So you can create a situation where you're still a participant in the marijuana revenue, but not receiving any in the marijuana economy, but not receiving the revenue. Part of the feedback I got from our last presentation was, does this all or nothing approach, if we took that all or nothing approach away, would that have the consequence of potentially encouraging counties to take a restrictive posture towards new marijuana licenses? So I reached out to the marijuana industry to sort of talk through this issue with them. So we had lengthy discussions with multiple participants, multiple marijuana businesses, cannabis businesses, and kind of tried to figure out this question of how on one hand do you create fairness in the distribution of funds so that each county's share of revenue is based truly on their contribution to the overall marijuana economy, and on the other hand, not necessarily encouraging a more restrictive piecemeal policy from county to county. And out of those discussions came the -4 amendment. The answer that we sort of came up with in those discussions is there's ought to be an opportunity for industry and community members to provide feedback to the county commission before such policy changes are made. So before a county opts out of one or more types of licenses, this amendment requires the convening of a cannabis advisory committee. And that committee would consist of the following: person who holds a production license, a person who holds a retail license, a designee of the county sheriff, a person from the county commission, a member of the public, a water master, and a representative of the county who's knowledgeable about economic development in the county. And that committee would be tasked with making recommendations to the county commission about the use of marijuana revenue, about how to increase public safety measures related to marijuana use and marijuana entities in the county, and other issues presented by the production, processing, wholesale, and distribution of marijuana in unincorporated area of the county. So this language, a lot of this language in this bill came from other advisory committees that are operating successfully within the state. And much of the language was actually taken from Rep. Marsh's district, the Jackson County Marijuana Advisory Committee. The request and from those discussions that there ought to be an opportunity to talk through some of these issues seemed very reasonable to me. And we were able to sort of try to replicate working models already. And I will say one of the sections in this bill now that really does stick out to me is that this advisory committee will make recommendations to the county commission about increases in public safety measures related to marijuana use and marijuana entities in the county. You know, my previous career, I was a Deschutes County Deputy District Attorney, and I did criminal and juvenile work. And I was involved with a lot of young people who were underage and using marijuana. And I know when I've had conversations with the marijuana industry, they are very worried about this issue and want to see resources used to combat underage use. But I also prosecuted cases where marijuana businesses were vandalized, were stolen from. And that is also a real issue of concern. And like I said, I have firsthand knowledge of prosecuting those cases when those marijuana and cannabis businesses were harmed by criminal behavior. And so that section speaks to me about the need for resources to make sure that our businesses can operate in a safe manner, but also make sure that we're promoting safe use and not use such as underage use or use in the operation motor vehicle, et cetera. So I think where we've ended up that we're presenting to you is that this legislation keeps a pathway forward for a county that is participating in the economy to still have some share of revenue. But if a county is contemplating an ordinance to opt out, has to commit itself to an advisory committee. And if they do opt out, they have to maintain that committee in perpetuity and meet in a quarterly fashion. So a county, I guess I'll use as an example, Deschutes County, which has opted out. If Deschutes County is to receive any revenue under this measure, it would have to impanel a cannabis advisory committee to make recommendations to the county about how to use marijuana revenue in our county or in counties. And I'm happy to take any questions on this. I have appreciated the previous feedback that I've gotten from committee members to continue to dig in on this issue. And it was, I thought, very fruitful discussions I had with different marijuana industry stakeholders about how to address some of the concerns that were initially brought forward with this bill.
Thank you, Representative Krupp. When you used the phrase opt out a couple of times in just the last minute or so, I'm assuming you mean opt out even it in just part rather than entirely opt out.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Chair. So, right, if you think about the four basic types of licenses, retail, wholesale, so a retail establishment, production, and processing, so growing or processing cannabis. Right now, if a county decides to opt out of just one of those types of licenses, Department of Revenue says you lose all revenue. What this bill says is your revenue is dependent on the amount of production and licenses that exist in your county. And if you have opted out of one of those types of licenses moving forward, you have to impanel a cannabis advisory committee.
If you opt out of any or all, yes.
Any or all. And you have to do that before you pursue an ordinance to opt out of any or all. And if the county does proceed with an opt out, they have to maintain that panel and meet at a quarterly fashion to advise the county commission.
Thank you. Representative Levy.
thank you, Chair. So Representative Krupp, I just have one question. So is any of this money that would come into the county be able to be used for law enforcement for illegal actions on marijuana growth? I know that in Rep. Marsh's district, Jefferson County, they have quite a bit of, or so I've been told, illegal activity going on in the marijuana industry, where the legal, you know, the legal people that have the business to sell it and that kind of stuff versus the growers, some of them not doing it legally. So will this provide money to law enforcement to help curb the illegal actions?
So thank you.
In any county, sorry, not just directed at Jefferson.
So roughly, thank you for that question. So each county would make their own decisions on how to use that revenue. Part of this bill would, the advisory committees would make recommendations to county. I would hope they would use that revenue for safety measures and to combat illegal grows. I mean, there was an interesting article in OPB today about Josephine County and what they're going through. And like I said, I have firsthand experience prosecuting cases where lawful marijuana businesses were subject to theft and vandalism, and those businesses deserve to be protected if they're operating in a lawful manner. So yeah. I can, from Deschutes County used its revenue for law enforcement and for substance abuse services.
Thank you very much for clarifying that.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Joe Nathanson. I just thought I would jump in with a word about Jackson County, since Rep. Levy noted it, although I think she had to leave for another meeting. Jackson County and Josephine County are overwhelmed right now with illegal grows. This issue is way bigger than teenagers getting weed. It's loads and loads and loads of illegal product being developed, apparently by out-of-state interests. And I just want to point out that the implications of what we're talking about here in the context. Jackson County used to get about $2.2 million a year in marijuana tax revenues from the state that we were able to put into code of enforcement and trying to respond to conditions on the ground. With the change with Measure 110, unless there is a backfill there in some way, that $2.2 million is going to be slashed to $500,000. And the code compliance issues alone are now in the hole for $800,000. So while I think Rep. Krupp is approaching this in the most thoughtful way possible, I remain concerned about further changes to the formula providing those tax revenues at this point, while so many other elements are still in flux.
And Chair, if I may, you know, Rep. Marsh, I share those concerns. I share those concerns for each county that allows for marijuana production in its county. And so this measure distributes, I believe, fairly those revenues to all the counties that participate in marijuana production and marijuana businesses based on the amount. Admittedly, Jackson County and Josephine County are our two largest producers of cannabis, and they receive significantly more marijuana revenue than other counties, and rightfully so. It is a larger industry in your county, and there are greater needs for that revenue. That doesn't take away from the need for revenue in other counties that are participating in the cannabis industry.
I'm going to take a turn here for a moment. Committee, we have had some other bills related to marijuana tax and distribution. We have had hearings on, for example, bills from Representatives Owens and Morgan. There's a bill from Representative David Brock Smith. Some of those bills are about either increasing a tax or enabling a new type of tax. Some of those bills would change the formula for distribution. And after we heard several of those earlier this year, it was felt and even suggested by Representative Morgan that the best thing to do would be to have a work group during the interim to talk about a number of these potential new or increased taxes. And that is certainly something that I intend to discuss with the committee, how to convene a work group and continue conversations on the interim to review issues that Representative Marsh and others are bringing up related to, for example, enforcement. Representative Valderrama.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nathanson. I thank you, Representative Krupp, for joining us again today. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you clarifying again that the bill doesn't impact the allocations for Measure 110 or potentially for the Oregon Equity Cannabis Act. Could you clarify, though, what impact it would have outside of those two buckets? My understanding is that it would, at least for Multnomah County, decrease our allocations. Can you talk about what impacts it would have?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Thank you, Representative Valderrama. So it doesn't change the formula, right? And we heard at the beginning of this hearing the 10% that is allocated to the counties, and then how that county, that 10% is distributed through the counties based on, I want to say acreage, but I think it's more like square foot. So how large of how much marijuana kind of cannabis is grown in your county and the number of licenses. So what has happened is Department of Revenue has interpreted the current statute. I think maybe the situation was unanticipated, that once a county has opted out of any of the different types of licenses, then that county no longer receives marijuana revenue. So that, you know, in my county, Deschutes County, that revenue has then been distributed for the last handful of months to the various counties based on their participation level. So basically we would go back to the formula that has existed since the beginning of the marijuana industry here in Oregon. So it wouldn't necessarily, there has been an increase, a small increase in distribution to counties over the last few months because of the Department of Revenue's current interpretation of the law, but we would go back to the way it had been distributed based on, in your county, Multnomah County, how much acreage do you have, how many licenses do you have in comparison to the rest of the state. And I believe I've provided those specific numbers to you. I don't have them handy. I'm certainly willing to circle back to you and sort of walk through the numbers that were previous and the numbers that now exist. And quite honestly, and Rep. Marsh talked about this, the biggest impact on marijuana revenue to our cities and counties has been the passage of Measure 110. That has had much greater financial impact than this measure. I think the estimates I got from Department of Revenue is currently Deschutes County share of revenue, if we were not an opt-out county, would be somewhere in the $150,000 per year range.
There is one other thing I would like to clarify with you, Rep. Krupp, which is opting out doesn't mean that you cancel and revoke existing licenses. It just means there will not be additional new licenses. Right. And as long as that's correct, that's something that I've discussed with one of the authors of the original legislation from some time ago, who assured me that was that the situation about the Department of Revenue interpretation was never discussed and certainly never intended, that was did not match up with this legislator's understanding of what they were adopting. It's just a consequence of a recent interpretation. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just wanted to make a quick comment. Although I know that there was ambiguity from the perspective of Deschutes County about whether or not leaving one license category or ceasing taking in new applications for one license category would affect their state tax revenues, I do want to say that as a legislator sitting in many hearings on these subjects, that was quite clearly expressed in hearings that I was a part of. There was not ambiguity. It was clear that a county or a city would have to be a full participant in the licensing process in order to get those tax revenues.
Chair Nathanson, if you don't mind.
Okay.
First off, Chair Nathanson, I really appreciate you sort of correcting my language in some respects. I feel like I've adopted this sort of language that was the initial language, which is like you're either an in or an out county. And that was the testimony we heard from Rob Beauvais. Like, we anticipated you're either going to be a county that was in or a county that was out. And I think actually you have a range of people on this committee that their counties represent that spectrum. And wasn't anticipated what has happened in Deschutes County, which is in has all four types of businesses that will continue to operate, but has passed an ordinance saying no more additional production or processing, still allowing for additional retail licenses, still allowing those existing businesses to continue to operate with no plans or, quite honestly, ability to stop that. Like I testified before, we are the ninth largest marijuana production county in the state, and that's not changing.
Thank you. I want to make sure that we do have ample time to for committee members to ask more questions or make some additional points. This is a good conversation in this work session. I'll wait just another few seconds here. I'm not seeing any additional hands. Someone speak up if I've missed one. It looks like we have come to the end of the questions and committee discussion on this bill. Thank you for being with us, Rep. Krupp, to explain the amendment and the work on the bill since we last heard it. I'm closing the work session now on House Bill 32. Yes.
I just want to bring your attention to the member because of the questions. I do have a table in your material.
Oh, good.
How the differences between the current law versus what happens under 3295 from changing the money from which counties and how much effect that would be for an annual and biennial type of effect. So that is in your material if you would like to look at it.
Thank you. Committee members, would anyone like to look at it while we're having our conversation right now, or you can access it individually? Thank you, Mr. Malik, for providing that detail for us to be reviewed. Okay, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3295.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3160.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, this is Caitlin Hargrove from the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 3160 deals with the establishment of the Oregon Wildlife Preparedness and Community Protection Fund. There are two amendments in OLIS that are summarized in the SMS. The first is the dash four, and that dash four removes the surcharge on insurance premiums from the bill. That's the main change. Then I believe there's a dash seven as well, and that establishes surcharges on different insurance premiums, which I've outlined in the SMS. I'm happy to talk through now if that would help. I do also want to mention just the impact of the retaliatory tax here. Anytime we increase taxes on insurers in Oregon, there is a retaliatory tax effect that affects the revenue that comes in. And so depending on the amendments and the related provisions, we could need to have a discussion about the retaliatory tax in more depth. Happy to answer any questions.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, and thank you, Caitlin, for that explanation. I did want to ask, does the retaliatory tax only have to do with insurance policies? I guess I didn't quite, I was hoping, I would love a little bit more information about how it relates to different charges in different states.
Sure. So Chair Nathanson and Rep. Pham, thank you for the question. The retaliatory tax does apply to insurance policies and not generally to other types of receipts. So it's something that's specific to the insurance industry. And the way it works is that if a foreign insurer, meaning an insurer that's located outside the state of Oregon, is operating in Oregon, the retaliatory tax takes into effect how much the Oregon company operating in their state would be taxed. And if the Oregon company operating in their state would face a higher tax rate, then Oregon imposes a retaliatory tax to make up that difference.
So it only applies to insurance policies. And in the case of a surcharge like this, and this is as drafted currently, if we increase taxes on policies in Oregon, that would increase the tax revenue coming to the state. But then due to the retaliatory tax, that would decrease the retaliatory tax revenue coming into the state as well. So it's kind of this this balancing effect between increases in revenue and decreases in revenue related to new tax provisions and the retaliatory tax.
Ms. Harger, I think you need to repeat that. The equation went by too quickly. I think what you said is that if we increase the tax in Oregon, the other state will then basically put a charge on that that would possibly then nullify the revenue, the positive revenue impact. Could you talk about that equation again?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Chair. So if Oregon were to increase taxes on insurers in any way, Oregon increases taxes on insurers. There are two types of insurers operating within the state, those that are located inside Oregon and those that are located outside of Oregon, but writing policies to Oregonians. So perhaps they're headquartered somewhere else. So in the case of those insurers, when they are paying taxes to Oregon, they fill out a form related to their retaliatory tax. And when that happens, they basically compare the tax burden in Oregon as well as the tax burden in their home state, and the retaliatory tax is the difference between those two. For Oregon insurers, what this means is that if an insurer is writing policies in Oregon and domiciled here and also writing policies in other states, if we increase taxes on insurers, then Oregon insurers can see that retaliatory effect in any other state in which they operate that also has retaliatory taxes. So there's a lot of moving pieces here, and I'm happy to try to explain this in additional ways that would be helpful. And I do think the DCBS is also in the room in case there are technical questions about the administration of that tax.
Well, could you go one step farther and say, who's actually billing who? Is it some Department of Revenue that's imposing a new tax, or is it something the insurer just says, oh, I'm going to decrease the amount of my tax check? How actually does it work?
So, Chair Nathanson, I believe the process is, in addition to their return, insurance companies fill out a specific form with the Department of Revenue, but I believe that DCBS manages the retaliatory tax portion, and then there's information sharing between DCBS and DOR. So I believe that they're paying the retaliatory tax to DCBS, and then that information and funding is then shared with the Department of Revenue.
Thank you. So I think now is a good time for DCBS to step in and add anything additional, and then we'll go to a question from Rep. Marsh.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, and apologies here, I'm having some IT difficulties. And Vice Chair Rischke, members of the committee, for the record, my name is TK Keen, and I'm the administrator with the Oregon Division of Financial Regulation. Happy to answer any questions you might have about retaliatory tax and how the process works. I think Ms. Harger did an outstanding job of describing the hydraulic effect that takes place and the actual basis that Ms. Harger was describing is calculated by each state and put into a guide that other states share among themselves. It's about 900 pages in length that goes through line by line of insurance what the retaliatory tax basis is and the reasoning for that tax. And so, as Ms. Harger described, as we add taxes here, that does play into the retaliatory tax impacts outside of Oregon.
Representative Marsh, I hope that you will also explain the work that you've done on this bill in the meantime.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I'm happy to do that. Is this a good moment?
Yes.
Okay. So after we had the public hearing a couple of weeks ago, we heard, and we've made a number of changes that are summarized in the Dash 7 amendment. Chair Nathanson, you're on mute. Okay, sounds like
Thank you. If someone has their microphone on and it wasn't me, please turn it off. Thank you.
Thank you. The first change we made was to put farm owners on the same homeowner schedule in terms of the fee. So farms would pay what homeowners pay, which is $10 up to a premium of $1,000 and $25 if a premium cost exceeds $1,000. So that was the first change. We made a technical fix that was requested by the Department of Revenue in terms of fee collections. We amended the bill to make it clear that we are excluding auto policies. We thought we'd done that, but we realized there was another change that we needed to make to do so. And then we made a change recommended by TK and his colleagues that makes it clear that life and health insurers are not implicated in the bill. So what we're trying to do is really get much more specific about the fees to be collected and the structure of those fees. Rep. Nathanson, I also had a question. Is it a
Yes, please go ahead.
So TK, could you discuss, because you first of all, thank you for the tremendous help you've been in as we've delved into these insurance issues. But could you describe where Oregon sits in terms of the 50 states in terms of our insurance taxation system and specifically around general premiums? You're on mute.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Rep. Marsh. Thank you for the question. And, you know, it's always a moving picture relative to other states. We are probably on the lower end of the scale in terms of our retaliatory tax basis. It is a moving picture year by year. And so as states like Oregon and others make adjustments to that, then a new manual of retaliatory tax basis is produced. Again, it's a pretty granular line by line. And so I think that gives some insight and color as to what Rep. Marsh was looking for there.
Is that all, Rep. Marsh?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Just the one specific question about a general premium tax is, my understanding is we are among the few or perhaps the only state without a general premium tax. Is that true?
Chair Nathanson, Rep. Marsh, that is correct as far as I understand it. At this moment in time, I think we are the only state without a pure, what's called a general premium tax. That's right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question and then a comment, if I may. And my question would be for Ms. Harger. Just what's the purpose behind the retaliatory tax system? What's trying to be accomplished there?
So Chair Nathanson and Representative Reschke, my understanding of the retaliatory tax system is that I guess the intent would be to retaliate against states increasing taxes in order to, retaliate against increases in taxation on insurers on a state-by-state basis.
Okay, thank you. I just always like to understand what the purpose behind a mechanism is before digging into the mechanism itself. So thank you for that. And then, Madam Chair, if I might have a comment on the bill itself.
Oh, sure. But before that, I'd like to step in and ask if Mr. Keene has any additional points to help illuminate what the purpose of the retaliatory tax is. Is it, for example, the national implication?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nathanson. And as Ms. Harger described, it's that's the policy basis for it. I think really the thought process is to make sure there's a level playing field among the states where you're doing business. And so you can't gain an advantage by being domiciled in a particular state or doing business in a particular state. You try to create a system by which everybody is taxed somewhat fairly and evenly. And in doing so, nationally, the tax rates and the consequences faced by insurance companies are approximately the same.
So is there literally a compact among all the states, or it's just sort of an informal agreement that all the states do this in a similar fashion?
Chair Nathanson, the legal mechanism by which this is done, I would have to go back to staff and find out. It is in statute, and I believe there are somewhat model statutes across states. And so, I think there is an agreement in terms of just how insurance is taxed generally, and that is different. And these taxes are accumulated differently in setting the marketplace. Is something that, in insurance, I guess is fairly unique from a tax basis. And so, I would need to do some research further into whether there's an actual like compact that holds us all together, but it's done by statute here in Oregon.
Thank you. Rep Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess my comment is that, and I'm going to build a crescendo here. How's that? So I know in California, I believe they're spending $2 billion of general fund money on wildfire protection. In Washington state, they're spending $500 million of general fund in wildfire protection. And we have a bill, Senate Bill 762, that's going to put $150 million into wildfire protection, I think is down in Ways and Means and do much of what this bill would do. So that my crescendo here is to my dash four, which basically takes away the tax altogether, considers the policy, and asks for $45 million to be put into wildfire recovery, so from the general fund. So it's just a different way of funding this as opposed to a permanent tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Reschke. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about the current level at which Oregon is taxing. I heard Rep. Marsh say that we're the only state, and Mr. Keene as well, you said we're the only state that doesn't have a general principal tax or something like that. Does that mean that we actually lower than other states? And I guess, does that mean that then having an additional tax would keep us at I know we probably can't compare to every single state, but does it more bring us to parity so it wouldn't trigger the retaliatory tax for most states? Or do you have some sense of like where our current tax levels compare to other states and how many states would trigger the retaliatory tax?
And Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, we do not have like a because it is by line of insurance and even pretty granular into that, we do not have like a master table that would say, compare Oregon explicitly against other states. And we've looked for that. We've tried to create that. It would really be a pretty difficult endeavor to do. I think when we were talking about the premium tax, the pure premium tax, it's always been a policy decision, at least as long as I've been with the agency, that there is not there has not been a premium tax established here. I believe that predates my time, and I believe it even may go back to several court cases that somewhat put in place some parameters around the tax structure here in Oregon on premium tax versus retaliatory tax. Be happy to do some research and pull that together for you. if that would be helpful. But yeah, I generally, when we've done some comparisons, it appears that Oregon would tilt towards the lower end of the retaliatory tax basis, the current structure. However, I would say, you know, each time, as we've noted, the hydraulic effect, each time we do raise a tax here, there is that implication of our own domestic insurance companies facing a possibility of their retaliatory tax basis when they go and do business in another state being raised. And so it can have that effect. And I just wanted to flag that and make sure that was understood.
Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So I apologize, I stepped out to testify on another bill. So I probably did not hear a question that you may have already answered. So as I understand it, that all states except Oregon subject insurance companies to premium taxes. With most states, they impose premium taxes in lieu of income taxes. So if we, will we be charging this, if we do this tax on the insurance companies, will they not have to pay the income tax? I mean, or am I not understanding that correctly? Can you explain that, Mr. Keene?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Levy, I would probably need to defer to Ms. Harger on that particular question because it involves, you know, income tax and the broader tax scheme. But I think we may be conflating a bit some of the issues. So we had a brief discussion about the premium tax in Oregon not having one, but we were digging in as well to a bit of the retaliatory tax scheme and the consequences there to 3160. So I'll turn it back to Ms. Harger on the broader tax implications.
Sure. So, Chair Nathanson and Rep. Levy, thank you for the question. I would say, setting aside the retaliatory tax piece for a second, insurers do pay income taxes in Oregon, and there's nothing in the bill that would change that income tax burden as it stands. So, like was discussed by TK in earlier information, there's not a gross premiums tax, but insurers do file a corporate tax in Oregon. So they are being taxed by the income tax system, and there's nothing in, I don't believe, in the current versions of the bill that would preempt them from taxation under that system.
And before I close, before I close the work session on this, we do have a couple of other bills to get to. I'd like to ask Mr. Alanak if he has anything to add, because this has been a sort of a complex topic for us this afternoon. Is there anything you'd like to add or clarify for us?
Sure, Madam Chair. I think the committee's touched on it one place or another, but to maybe put a encapsulate a little bit. Back in the mid-90s, and I think TK referred to some of this, back in the prior to 1995-ish, we did have a gross premium tax. All of the insurers moved from the premium tax to the corporate income tax. So we got rid of the premiums tax, and they got replaced by the corporate income tax, or the excise tax that Kate just referred to. So there is a particular form that insurance companies pay for the corporate excise income tax. So that's one of the dynamics here that makes this confusing and makes Oregon an outlier in the insurance industry about how we tax those companies. And the other piece that I'm not sure if it's clear is that part of the issue we want to make sure we're clear with moving forward on the bill is that there can be a gain to the fund identified in the bill related to the surcharge, but then that can be a revenue loss to the general fund due to the retaliatory tax dynamic. So we just want to be aware of that. So in some ways, it looks like a fund shift. And if that's what's desired, that's fine. We just want to be aware of the retaliatory tax impacts, because in my experience, that has caught some members off guard about, well, wait a minute, how does this work? And it is a very unusual tax. So just a couple of pieces there to keep in mind.
Rep Marsh, do you have any final thoughts for us before we close the work session on 3160?
Ah, finally got off mute. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I certainly acknowledge the complexity of the retaliatory tax system. I think it is significant that we do have a lower tax burden, and that may be because, in part, because of the shift to an income tax for the industry. I do continue to think there's a strong nexus between property tax insurance policies and fire risk, which is what we're trying to address here. And that's how we got into this conversation. And I want to acknowledge Rep. Reschke's concept of the fund. I think what we've done a couple things in this piece of legislation. One is to really take a serious dive into the kind of program that we need here in Oregon on an ongoing basis in order to make sure that we are doing everything we can to protect communities and to enable our agencies to engage in recovery activities after a fire has taken place. So the fund and the development of the fund and the way we've allocated the sources of money and the agencies that we've engaged is is the result of a lot of conversation, and I think has inherent value in it. How we get the money into that fund is the other part of the bill, and we'll continue to think about that. So thank you, Chair Nathanson.
Sure. I'm closing the work session. Oh, Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick process question, not on the content of the bill, but the process it would take. If we were to move it forward with either the -4 or as the base bill or with the -10, would it go to Ways and Means next? And I don't know if you know that answer, or maybe Mr. Allenack does.
Mr. Allenack?
Rep. Reschke. Madam Chair, I don't think we know the answer to that yet. We would want to communicate with LFO. I would think so. First blush, you're creating a fund and then want to keep track of it. So my early guess would be that it would probably need to go there, but we would reach out to LFO to confirm that.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Rep. Reschke. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3160. Opening a work session on House Bill 3373, and while LRO steps up to explain it, I will mention to the committee, we have just 15 to 20 minutes. We might be able to cover both of these bills. We'll see how it goes. House Bill 3373, please.
Chair and members of the committee, sorry about that. I had some problems with mute. This bill you have seen before in the committee, and it deals with establishing an Office of Taxpayer Advocacy in the Department of Revenue. There is a -2 amendment posted in OLIS and summarized on the SMS. And the two main changes I think here are that it requires the Office of Taxpayer Advocacy to abide by all confidentiality and disclosure provisions that the Department of Revenue currently provides in general with respect to returns. It also provides the taxpayer advocate the authority to issue orders related to taxpayers experiencing significant hardship, which is defined in the bill, due to action by the Department of Revenue. And it allows the director or the deputy director of the department to overturn that order. But it does grant the ability to make those orders to the taxpayer advocate. And I'm happy to answer any questions on the bill.
Thank you. And we do have the director of the Department of Revenue here to explain the content of an amendment. Ms. Imholt, are you here?
I am. Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Betsy Einholt, Director of the Oregon Department of Revenue, and LRO did a great job of describing the amendment that's before you, the -2. I would just add there's one other additional bit that I would just mention, which is some additional reporting to the legislature direct from the taxpayer advocate that comes directly to you without any filtering from anyone at the department. And that that includes a number of pieces of information that would allow you to have information by which to inquire department activities, but also information by which you may want to act upon to improve revenue systems throughout the state. With that, I'll just pause and take any of your questions.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Director Imholt. Good to see you again. My question is about number of staff you think you'll need to fill this position and this office. I think the last time we talked, it was four. I'm just making sure that number is the same, or has it gone up or gone down in your estimation?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Reschke. We are estimating at three and phased in over the course of the biennium. And the reason it's gone from four to three is because the grant program that was in the dash one version that you last saw is now not included. So that would remove operations and policy analyst two that we had slated to be included.
So three is what I'm hearing then. Is that correct?
Correct. That's all correct. Right.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Imholt, it's my understanding that the amendment is addressing some interest in assuring the independence of this office. Could you speak just a little more broadly, not so much about the technical words in the amendment, but why there's an amendment in front of us?
Sure, Madam Chair. I'm happy to do so. In the very first hearing that we had on this bill, there was some testimony around wanting some increased independence for this office. So we worked offline through the sponsor's office with those stakeholders that raised those issues. This was mostly coming from the business community to address those concerns. We really looked to the models that are in place, really at the IRS, which is really the gold standard for doing so, and kind of started there and then worked on language that we all came to agreement on. One is making sure that you're getting the direct reporting from the taxpayer advocate, and then the new provision around this taxpayer assistance orders that was not included in the original version or the original dash one amendment, but it is included in this dash two amendment, and it's a provision that we're comfortable with.
Thank you very much. I'll wait a few seconds to see if there are any hands for additional questions. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Director Imholt, I was just wondering about how somebody's going to contact this office. So if I have questions and I'm not getting the response from DOR that I want, or maybe I'm not getting a clarity I want and I think I need an advocate to help me work through the system, is there going to be a special number set up or a website, or what are the plans for that part of the program?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Reschke, all of the above. I think that would be a lot of the work ahead, is to make sure that this resource is made available far and wide, and that would be through social media, through our website, through any channel in the community by which we could establish partnerships to make sure that people were aware, and that includes through multiple languages as well. So I can't pretend that I have a plan in place, but that would be immediate work that would have to begin immediately. And that's one of the reasons too, we'd want to phase these positions in over time. So it would give us time to get a plan and then hire the positions as that plan would allow.
Thank you.
Yep. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Imholt, for coming to present. I just wanted to offer a quick comment about I appreciate the thoughtfulness with which you're approaching this in terms of rolling out the staff, thinking about how do we increase transparency and also the right amount of independence and authority. I'm just coming from community-based organizations where people have so much fear and just confusion about taxes. I think this is a really important step. to allow our government and the DOR to be more proactive in terms of helping people to understand the Department of Revenue, their tax system, and not be so hesitant to file taxes and hopefully get the benefits that they deserve through whether it's the Earned Income Tax Credit or whatever other program they're eligible for.
Thank you, Rep. Pham. I don't see any other hands. Mr. Alanak, anything you can think of to add before we move to our final work session today?
I don't think so, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Ms. Imhold, for being here. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3373. As mentioned earlier, House Bill 2630 is being carried over. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3069A, and I'm sorry we don't have a lot of time, but we do want to at least hear from the proponent about the amendment. LRO, 1 minute to catch us up on where we are on this bill.
Sure, of course, Madam Chair. So, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 3069 establishes the 988 Suicide Prevention and Mental Health Crisis Hotline. The amendments in front of you today, the dash A8 removes the tax provisions from the bill, and the dash A10 removes the tax provisions as well. It declares an emergency, and then it defines some terms related to the administration, and then also provides some rulemaking authority. And I'm, of course, happy to answer any questions if they come up.
Thank you. Is Rep. Sanchez with us? I'd like to hear from either the governor's office or OHA or whoever has a primary, whoever is the primary contact in place of Rep. Sanchez to hear about the amendment.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, and Vice Chair Reschke. Members of the committee, my name is Jackie Irby, and I'm the governor's policy advisor for behavioral health and health licensing. And I'm here with my colleague, Tristan Fernandez from the Oregon Health Authority. And Tristan can take us through the amendments in detail. So Tristan, you're available.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Vice Chair. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, and Vice Chair Risky, and members of the committee. I'm Tristan Fernandez, for the record, I'm Tristan Fernandez, a policy analyst at the Oregon Health Authority, and I provided technical assistance to the governor's work group in drafting the amendment before you today. In short, since we're tight on time, the primary goal of this amendment was to align the legislation to the SAMHSA best practice, the minimum best practice guidelines that came out from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration from the federal government at the end of February, while the legislative session had already begun. This provides a kind of a floor for the requirements, as well as provide the rulemaking authority for the defined terms within the SAMHSA guidelines that allows OHA to go forward and start the licensing and certification needs throughout the state or a statewide coordinated crisis system. The additional amendments, as you heard from the committee staff, was that now that the taxation portion is completely removed from the bill, there does not need to be a staggered implementation anymore. And given the federal legislation that requires a July of 2022 implementation, OHA does need to start their rulemaking as well as their certification pretty much immediately. So therefore, we've just simplified the bill down by not having staggered implementation dates. But primarily throughout the rest of the bill, it is aligning with those minimum standards of SAMHSA.
Thank you. committee members, questions for the governor's office or Oregon Health Authority on the status of this bill, given the amendment that we are seeing today? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see me now, right? Is that correct? Because so you can see the smile on my face at no new taxes. So I'm a happy camper in that regard. But I have questions as far as policy goes, but that's not the purview of this committee. So I'll hold those comments till later. But glad to see the A10 take out the tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Reschke. Questions or discussion from other committee members? I'll give it another few seconds. I'm not seeing any. Thank you all for being available to us. LRO, any final comments before I close the work session on House Bill 3069?
Madam Chair,
Go ahead, Kate.
I was just going to say, I think Rep. Sanchez might be in the room now, so I just wanted to flag that for you. I know you asked.
Oh, thank you. Rep. Sanchez, I hear that you are in the room with us now. We're just about done. We're a little bit over our meeting adjournment time, but we'd love to hear from you if there's something you'd like to add.
You know what? I'm sure that the team did an amazing job at presenting the bill and the current amendments. So thank you so much for taking the time to hear the information and, of course, the amendments that we brought forward to it. So.
Sure. Well, it was very brief. They did a stellar job in just condensing it into a very brief period. The takeaway for me is that the amendment was important because it's now aligning this bill with some very recent federal policy guidance that's been issued.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we believe that it sets us in a nice trajectory to allow OHA to start doing the processes that they need to move this all forward. And of course, in the larger behavioral health system, to align all of these different pieces in a way that will make sense for the state of Oregon in the long run.
Thank you for joining us today, Rep. Sanchez.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And everybody else. Okay, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3069A. Mr. Alanak, anything else to tell us about before we adjourn for the day?
Just a reminder to the committee members that tomorrow you're meeting at your regular time, 3:15, except you will not be House Revenue. You will be half, give or take, of the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures, the initial meeting for the Joint Committee.
Thank you for that reminder and explanation. And Mr. Alanak, because I'm carrying over House Bill 2630, the meeting tomorrow is not a regular House Revenue Committee meeting, so that means that 2630 would be carried over to the next day after that. Is that correct?
Correct, ma'am. Correct, Madam Chair. It'll be Thursday.
Okay, good. Thanks, everybody. We're adjourned.